Welcome to this JPN episode, during which I talk with Anne-Louise Davidson, who runs the Innovation Lab at Concordia University. As a warning, I recorded this conversation back in March 2021, just a few weeks before Anne-Louise was able to officially launch the lab. During our conversation, we covered a lot of ground going back to Anne-Louise's childhood experiences, leading to learning experiences and an approach to learning which really fits in terms of creativity and curiosity. Anne-Louise's experience with makerspaces is relatively rare in higher education, and I think you will enjoy how her approach brings a new perspective on the work we do as learning professionals. Anne-Louise also addresses issues surrounding networking as opportunity seeking, and we briefly discuss differences between Ontario and Quebec, especially as it relates to CEGEPs. So I hope you will enjoy this episode, and feel free to comment at the bottom in our page on eductive.ca. Thank you. So my first question is basically how you describe yourself, how you introduce yourself to people, what your role is. I know you have many hats, but what's your typical thing, especially in, you know, in higher education and especially among people who consider themselves to be professionals at learning?
Yeah. Well, it's a question that I think needs to start from what I think of myself as a person. The first thing is that I think I'm really, what defines me is that I'm a curious person. I'm curious about everything. I'm not curious about education in general. I'm curious about science. I'm curious about the environment. I'm curious about people. I'm curious about how things work. Like when I see something, I'm like, how does this work? Like what's the mechanics behind this? Who actually thought of this? Like, who was the first person who came up with the idea of eating like a, I don't know, like a snail? What was in your mind? So this curiosity is what brought me to university. And I think it's important for me to state that I never knew what I wanted to do in my life. And I think I still don't know what I want to do in my life. But I started with fine arts. I started a degree in fine arts. And that brought me through French literature, as well as foreign language. And that was my first degree, sort of like an amalgam of all three, mostly fine arts and French literature, but also foreign language. And then I went to study in education, and I got my teaching degree, which brought me also to think that maybe I want to do a master's in education. And I was recruited by a professor who said, you know, you should do a thesis in administration and foundations of education. Now that person passed away during my degree, but then I found another team who was working on technology.
Okay.
That's how I got into technology, but I never took a technology course or a technology in education course per se. When I was finishing my master's degree, there was a prof, François Desjardins, who was there, who said, well, I'd love to have you as a doctoral student, and you should do a PhD. So I decided to do part of the journey with him. I would call him more an epistemology expert of education, which to me includes anything that will structure your thought, which is what I think technology is in any way. It's a way to unframe your thinking. Whether it's digital or not, could be, you know, for all I know, post-its or index cards or masking tape on the floor. Whatever it is that you are using is a technology to inform your thinking. Some of it is digital, some of it is analog, some of it is more physical. After my PhD, I followed an anthropologist, a cultural anthropologist at Carleton University. And I did sociology and anthropology there. And then I was hired at Concordia in EdTech. You know, since then, you know, you could also say, you know, I'm a black sheep in any way, because in a way, because I'm never from a particular discipline. I just bring in a series of conjectures, a series of arguments, a series of models and thinking patterns that allow me to work in different environments. So I sort of followed the traditional educational technology research path until my tenure. And obviously that's because of the, you know, publish or perish culture. And it's also because you're trying to get integrated into a system. And then when I went on my first sabbatical, I started hanging out a lot in makerspaces. Mm-hmm. And I found, and there was only like a trigger for that. It's because in 2012, I bought Raspberry Pi when it came out. And it was on my desk. And then it moved to my shelf. And then it moved to a drawer. And then when I was in sabbatical, I just thought, okay, like, well, how am I going to treat myself to this sabbatical? And I landed in a makerspace because I heard that they had done a project with a Raspberry Pi and I wanted to learn how to use it. And I hadn't, there was not enough resources online. It was quite complicated at the time. And, you know, the way for me to get access to that information was through makerspaces. And the first place I visited, they said, no, we don't, but there's a hackerspace. And I'm like, oh, there's a hackerspace. That's cool. Let me go hang out there. Yeah. So I spent time hanging in makerspaces, hackerspaces to uncover a learning culture, which I was craving for. And that's basically what landed me with the idea. That's how I landed with the idea of like Concordia should have a research chair in maker culture. And we should have Concordia University makerspace for research, not just a community makerspace, but a place for students to engage in material culture in a way that is not just research creation in terms of fine arts. And now, as COVID hit, I lost access to my makerspaces and all the maker equipment, and I created the Innovation Lab, which is under the Provost's Office, Vice Provost of Partnerships and Experiential Learning Portfolio. Mm-hmm. And it's an institutional project. I'm about to launch this, I guess, next week or in 2 weeks. I keep on pushing the deadline. It's just because our website is not all quite ready, but at this point in time, I'm running the lab virtually with a team of 20 students. It's interesting because people were worried about the lab, and when I launched the call for participation, it was in the middle of exams in December, and they told me, oh, Eloise, maybe you're going to have to get into your network because we don't know if you're going to get a cohort. And in the span of barely 10 days, I got 200 applications.
Yeah.
Students calling this mesmerizing, curiosity-inducing, fascinating. I mean, they love the idea. And what I simply proposed were four challenges. One, which is designing better face masks for COVID-19. Mm. And it's a partnership with the Aerosol Filtration Lab and IRSST. Another one, which is a community-run CRM. And another one, which is a neighborhood free Wi-Fi, and another one, which is Maker Fundamentals. So each challenge has partners and mentors that are from the partner associations. And now I'm creating new ways of mentoring, which is, you know, more subject matter experts, partners, contextual partners that can actually mentor students. So the students are connected to a variety of people and resources. And they're out there trying to figure out like how to get this challenge going. And they're working in multidisciplinary teams because they're students from all four faculties. So I'm exploring challenge-based learning, which is a diversion from the usual problem-based learning or case-based learning that I usually do. But it's highly relevant when working with external partners. So
yeah.
I'm bringing them through a design thinking cycle and sort of exploring. I mean, design thinking has its pluses and minuses, but what I figured is I'm just going to let myself run through this to stress test the process and to see where I can feel comfortable with it, where I'm not. And as I go through it, I reflect on the practices that I engage in and I create better instruments that are less constraining than what I already have. So that's what it is.
And it's almost like design thinking process itself. It's a little bit meta that you're going through it reflexively, that it's not just about applying some principles that you heard about, but to actually do some groundwork and field research on this, right? It sounds like it.
Well, I think that's what it is to work as in education, right? Like les sciences de l'éducation or the field of education as a research field, you're always working at a meta level. And whether you're thinking of training teachers or you're creating learning experiences to engage people in professional development, or you're thinking of how to improve pedagogy with teachers, or you're actually thinking about your own pedagogy, right? Like, how do I engage in better pedagogy? And very often when I think about, you know, how I will meet students, I don't think of content anymore. I mean, I know that I'm an expert of my content, and there is some content that I have no expertise in, but I know how to get it. I'm highly connected. I'm very networked, and I have access to a lot of people who are much better than I am. So I always have this attitude of, if I don't have it, I know how to solve it. But more importantly, when I prepare myself to meet students, it's basically like, how will I meet them? Like, what does this look like to meet a student and intersect with a student whose field I have zero expertise of?
Yeah. And that, you know, your power as a networker, as a connector, that probably has had a part to play in the fact that you had so many applications for this one, right? Like, if you got 200 applications, which was surprising for people around you, it's probably because you had not only access to this network, but that you built it, right? Do you feel that it's important to build those networks, like this whole idea about connectedism, but also just network-based learning and personal learning networks and all of these things? Do those connect? Do they contribute to something?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're only as good as our network. That's basically one of the fundamental postulates by which I work. And if I go back to, you know, the power of networking, a lot of people say, well, networking is empty. Networking is, you know, ridiculous. It's empty. I hate networking. Like, I feel so useless. And it is true, Alex, that some networking is uncomfortable. Like, I can just picture myself when I have to go to a high-end network event and, you know, I have to dress in a way that is not me. I have to wear jewelry because people will look at my hands if they're naked. They're going to say, who is she? I really, really dislike that. That's one part of networking. And then you can't get into a conversation. It's just like, basically you're like a butterfly, you know, tasting a bunch of flowers. And like, you know, I call that butinage, you know, like, or you're a bee tasting like a bunch of flowers, but you're just introducing yourself. And then as soon as the conversation starts, the person you're speaking to goes, oh, I have to go. And then they leave. And you're like, what am I missing here? But the real networking that I think is worthwhile is the networking where you're developing your skills at opportunity seeking. And I sometimes prefer to call it opportunity seeking rather than networking. But you're really going to ask yourself, like, what do I need to learn, and where can I meet a person, or which event can I join to meet people that will actually expand my learning? So it's a little bit like learning by expansion in the Engstrom kind of approach, which is, you know, there's a community out there, and there are tools I can have access to, and there's a division of labor, and there are rules I need to think about, and there's an object. So I'm going to focus on the object, and I'm going to ask myself, like, where can I intersect, and where can I create these opportunities for me to get connected with this context and this environment where these things can happen? And it's kind of interesting that I'm telling you this, because as a kid, I was bullied. I was a bullied kid in school. I was the geek, right? And that nobody wanted to be friends with because I was weird. And you turn to me as an adult, and, you know, I'm not afraid of being bullied or being cold-shouldered. So I just figure, I'm just going to go where love is.
Yeah. But, and you described yourself as a black sheep earlier, and all of this comes together in some ways. Like, do you perceive that it's a common pattern for people in this field, that we come from different backgrounds, but probably what unites us in part is that we're apart from some other people in some ways, at least in terms of inclusion? Like, you seem to care a lot about inclusion, right, in your work. Like, what we can perceive from the outside is that it matters not just as a thing to add, as a checkbox. It's something that you delve deeply into, and maybe it comes from that experience of being bullied and so on. You don't have to expand on that, but to understand from that perspective, from that experience, and to prevent it from for others, or something like that.
Well, it's It certainly tints my experience, and it certainly tints how I see events. I can't guarantee that the people who work with me don't get bullied, because there are certain types of bullying that I don't see. We're always blind to other people's bullying, but I can certainly be sensitive to the law of requisite variety. We need, for a system to work well, it needs to be present in a variety of states with a variety of agents and a variety of procedures. And as from systems thinking, but if I use that on a human scale, what it actually means is that the more I can bring in a variety of perspectives, and the more I can allow a variety of people to speak, and the more I can bring in, you know, various disciplines, various experiences, people from all strands of life, people with, you know, who are not representative of the majority, the more the conversation is rich.
Yeah.
There is certainly something about, you know, something interesting about people who were bullied as kids, or people who see themselves as weirdos or black sheeps or whatever, in terms of their life experience, because there's a lot of maturity that comes in later on in life. And, you know, at one point you start seeing people who pass away. Yesterday I have a childhood friend who passed away at 49 of cancer. And I didn't know he was sick. I just saw it on Facebook. And it hits me every time that we are given a chance. And we have to make the best of this every day. And regardless of past experiences, we can be like zebras. And we could say the threat was present in the past, and it's no longer present. And today, let me be the best version of myself. Let me push as far as I can so that I can do the kinds of things I need to do in the span of the lifetime I've been given. And I don't know how long that's gonna last, but what's important is that I push as far as possible, and the people who are around me can actually see all of these things as opportunities. With me, there's no limit.
Yeah.
Right? Well, if the limit is, if you're doing nothing, then you can't follow. But with me, there's no limit to where you wanna go, what you wanna do. There's no, I don't impose a recipe, I don't impose, you know, a research project. I don't impose a particular way of doing things. It's like everything is, you know, this and, oh yeah, it can also be this, and it can also be done this way, and. So yeah. I think it's that attitude of seeing people, it doesn't have to fit the mold, that I think is part of my way of thinking, which I enact in my practice.
Absolutely. And there's a strong connection with what you were saying about curiosity, right? Introducing yourself as being curious about everything prepares you to do that kind of work, you know, to have the flexibility of mind to go deeper into that. And speaking of which, was there anything in your background that created those conditions that you would be curious? Was there any, you talked about some people who enabled you through your studies, but I'm kind of guessing that it was something even, you know, before that, where you were allowed to explore, you were allowed to be curious, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot that can go there. The first part is that I come from a small town, from a ordinary family with I had a lot of uncles. My grandmother had 13 children, and the resources were limited in terms of objects, but they were not limited in terms of people. And my uncles were all makers, and without the education to be a maker. And I remember very, very clearly at one point, it was spring, and my mother told me, like, when there's no more ice in the street, then you can take your bike out. So I take my bike out, and, you know, we put some air in it, and I realize that it's not keeping air. Like, I go for a spin, and then, you know, I have a flat tire. I have to walk back home with the flat tire, and I didn't know what to do. So, you know, somebody said, well, we're going to have to bring the bike to the garage. I don't know when we can do this, and, you know, it's going to cost a lot, so we have to think about that. And I thought, this is so sad, because I was waiting for my bike, and my uncle comes in and he says, what's the problem? And I said, you know, I have a flat tire. And he said, well, let's just dismantle this. Then he takes the tube and he puts it in water, and then we see air coming out. And then he says, well, that's where the hole is. And then you know, pulls out a little kit, he makes a patch, and then he puts a brick on it, and then he tells me we have to wait, 24 hours. And, you know, I'm looking at this 24 hours, and how long do I have to wait for this? But I remember the magic of putting air back in my tire, and it was holding air. And then he said, you know, eventually you'll have to find a trip, but we can do this. It's going to cost you very little. Just go buy it. This is the size you need. So I went to Canadian Tire, and I bought a trip, but it's a tube that I use the French word, but sure. But then I knew that we had tools, we had people, I could do part of this. I was not strong enough, but I could ask for some help. I knew the process, and it was no longer a mystery. All of a sudden, this idea of a tire that holds air is no longer opaque for me. So this idea of uncovering things, dismantling things, understanding how things are made, come from a very young age where, to me, people who could do things were almost they were almost divine, because they were making miracles with their hands. And just by being able to do this, they were able to, you know, achieve whatever success they wanted in life or do the activities they wanted. And for me, having my bicycle in a small town was a great enabler, because then I could go see friends and I could do the kinds of things I wanted to do. But it also goes back to, you know, the first time I went to see a movie, I was seeing this, it was called the Théâtre Jean in Hawkesbury, and I was seeing, you know, these images, and then this like 10, 9, 8, like there was a timer, and then it started. And at one point, you know, the sound slowed down, and then it turned black, and then whoops, the movie started again. And then I turned and I looked and I saw that there was a projector, and I wondered, like, what's in that room? What's happening in there? Like, there's somebody there doing something, but what is this? And when I asked the question, it was my dad's cousin who was the operator and putting the film together. And he brought me the next time inside the room, and I saw like how you create film. I'm like, wow, like this is so fantastic. Like, to me, understanding how mysterious things ended up happening, like how you would see the succession of images, and it looked like a real life movie, but it was all on a tape with a succession of, you know, printed images. So then I went back home, and then, you know, I started thinking about that, how that would look like. And he told me, you know, if you take a book and you create enough cartoons. So I started doing like stick people, and I was obsessed with those. Like, I was making so many of them, and actually I was cutting pieces of paper to create more of these things. It was all over my world. I mean, I went from, you know, the large size ones, the very small size one, and I had those in my pocket. I would bring them in school, and I would show this to people. Like, to me, the fascination of understanding how things work was at the core of who I was as a child.
Absolutely. And what's fascinating there, part of it, is that there's a lot of discussion as to whether or not educational systems encourage this, right? It tends to be kind of almost a trope that we kill creativity and such, but it sounds like you were able to maintain this. Those were, you know, deep learning experiences, and you can certainly describe it to your students in education and things like that, right? To other people, but you perceive that there's an appetite for including this type of learning in more formal schooling context and things like that?
Well, there is certainly, there are always some people who keep the flame for learning. It's interesting because today I was interviewing someone for my own research, and he was talking about, you know, this, when you do robotics, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a group that goes woo, and then everybody stops doing what they want, and they come and see, and then there's like this moment of intensity, which I've called the maker scream at one point, because I saw it too. It's like when something works and a group goes, this is working, and then the intensity goes up and up and up. It's almost hard to document this, but if you've seen it happen, you know. Right, there's a fire that was ignited, like feu qui a été allumé. This is how I say it in French. But some people, somehow in adulthood, lose, like sometimes through adolescence, lose the pleasure of play, lose the pleasure of letting free. And, you know, obviously some of these people become teachers, and they've flattened the experience. Everything has to be serious because this is school, there's a curriculum, there are tests. And I think that there is space for everything. And I wouldn't want a whole education system to be revolutionized and only work around play, because obviously we've seen what happens, you know, when a whole school goes on video gaming. But I think that there is, again, you know, let me go back to the law of requisite variety. A system needs to be able to exist in various states with agents that have varieties of roles and tasks and a variety of methods that are not all the same. If you add back some of that play inside the environment, some of that flexibility to create and explore things that really matter, I think it becomes much more interesting. And I think that, you know, I've suffered through a lot of my studies because, especially, you know, as we reach the end of high school and we enter university, then everything somehow has to be very, very serious. Everything has to be very academic, scholarly, respecting, you know, the academia and the rules that were set by previous scholars. But then there's always space for your own projects. There's always space because you will need a professor somewhere who will give you that space. And I think that I started enjoying my studies much more at the PhD than the other degrees that I did, because I was all of a sudden able to work on the kinds of things that ignited me. And as a professor, I can tell you that I never stay in a field for very long, in a specific field. And, you know, some people might accuse me of being interdisciplinary and being too spread out. And that's who I am, and I will never stop that. I'm starting an innovation lab now. I'm already thinking of three other projects that I want to work on. I'm not going to stay only in one field because I feel as though the world is advancing at a rate that is exponential. And we need to be connected to the kinds of expectations that the workforce has for our students, but also making them better human beings, more fully fledged contributing citizens that not only contribute but are healthy. So the more I can bring relevance inside the university, the happier I am. And that's my new fascination, if you want. So it's not going to stop. And I think that that's my role, but I don't think everybody can take that role because it's extremely straining. It's energy consuming. I'm always, you know, I can tell you, Alex, like when I go to bed at night, like sometimes I fall asleep on I have a little is behind here. I work with my computer and I fall asleep on the futon that's in there, and I rarely reach my bed because I'm just exhausted. So sometimes at 3 a.m. I wake up and I'm like, oh yeah, I have to get in my pajamas and get to bed. But this is the kind of fascination that I have. I work on projects. I'm fascinated by my projects. They consume me. I consume them. The whole idea of like, how can I uncover better ways to educate people? How can I open networks? How can I create experiences that will bring more relevance inside the university? That's what consumes my thinking, my thought.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to keep this kind of short for people, but we could go on, and I know it would be awesome. And one part where you have a privileged point of view perspective as given the border between Quebec and Ontario. And I don't think that people in Quebec think about that so much, but you know, Franco-Ontarian culture is not necessarily discussed commonly in Quebec. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about educational systems, and there's been a lot of reforms in both provinces. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit as to your perspective on Quebec's educational system, but also specifically on CEGEPs, because, you know, you get students who came from CEGEPs, and people across the world don't know anything about the CEGEPs, right? Yeah. Recently, I did Canadian-splaining, like kind of mansplaining to a Canadian. I didn't know she was Canadian, but I was explaining CEGEPs to her. And then she said, you know, well, I'm from Ontario, like you don't have to tell me. But a lot of people are either surprised or puzzled because it's a little bit different. And because the educational system in Ontario is different, do you perceive differences, advantages and disadvantages? And
well, I came from Ontario, so I could tell you that when I entered university in fine arts, I was very surprised to see that the people who came from Quebec knew almost everything that we were about to learn, and I had done other things, but not that. So they were much more specialized than I was. And I think that in some cases, I mean, it's always like, do you specialize yourself or do you go broad? If you go broad, you have more opportunities and you can expand. If you are more specialized, it's harder to jump from one field to the other. I think that both systems have their value. The Quebec system definitely has an advantage when students get to university, especially if they want to study in the field that they were in CEGEP. Where it becomes problematic is where people jump fields, and also where people, the Quebec universities are, especially the more science-oriented fields, have very, very specific expectations. So it's very hard to change over. And in Ontario, it's a little bit different. It's much easier to change. So the question is, do we develop hyper-specialists or we do open opportunities? And I guess where my hesitation is when you're 17 years old, it's very hard. I mean, I'm 49. I don't even know what I want to do in my life. So when I was 17 and I went to study in fine arts, it was only because I was good in fine arts. I was I was good at a lot of things, but that fascinated me more than other traditional, you know, subjects. And it was also because I had decided at the time, I had applied also to l'Astée Collégiale. It was the first year it was on. They had created the programs. There was a program in graphic design, and I was accepted there with a big bursary. And my dad told me, well, if you go to university, at least you can change. And if you go to college, then you'll be stuck into the program that you studied. If you don't complete it, then it's as good as nothing. In university, you can always reuse your credits to do something else. And I think, you know, deep inside his heart, he was hoping that I would not stay in fine arts because of the idea of, like, how do you monetize that? And yeah. He was right, but at the same time, studying in fine arts has defined who I am as a person. Even though for the longest time I thought it was useless, and I didn't particularly like being a fine arts teacher in high school. I was an arts teacher for quite a while, and you end up with a lot of problems in your class because, you know, orientation counselors, guidance counselors see this as a dumping ground for students who are not succeeding elsewhere, so they all land in your class. So as a fine arts teacher, you're more like a special education teacher who also teaches students who are not in special education, and you're not really recognized as an expert. You're recognized as a, well, anybody can draw kind of thing. So there was a challenge there for me, but at the same time, I could see that changing fields has been extremely beneficial. And I think that the issue with the CEGEP system is how it actually channels people into a field where they're not feeling as though it's easy to change.
Yeah. So, and it's almost an argument for badges. Like, we've worked on badges in the past, and nowadays it's becoming more of a thing because the hype cycle went over. Like, it's not about the hype anymore. It's more about, like, oh, there's an opportunity there to develop something that you develop a skill, and it can be recognized even though you're not done. Yeah. Even a course, that's one thing, is that, you know, I had to leave the course to withdraw from the course, and institutions are really concerned about registrations, enrollment.
Yeah.
But if you succeeded with what you wanted to get, maybe that's enough. And I know that in Ontario right now, there's a big push for micro-certifications. So that's something that we can use as inspiration even. And it's also interesting, you know, just going back and in a way to wrap up, because it goes back to what you were saying about networking as opportunity seeking. It might be the case, and I don't know what you think about this, that's what I'm interested in, is like, it might work extremely well for people who are either open to any opportunity or have a very specific opportunity in mind, like a thing they want to do. But maybe in between those people who are just seeking themselves out, like trying to understand themselves, maybe it's harder. So different systems and different techniques, including networking itself, it can work really well for certain people, not just in terms of extroversion, which is, you know, a classical thing, but also in terms of I'm going there with a purpose in mind.
Yeah.
Versus someone who's like, I really don't know what I want to do, and not having the support to find that out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no one-size-fits-all approach to networking or opportunity seeking. Sometimes it's just getting to know people. Sometimes it's more about, you know, thinking of a project. Other times it's thinking of a skill you want to develop. And sometimes it's just about, you know, giving time and helping people out. So whatever might come out of networking or opportunity seeking, I guess people will find different ways of doing it and different advantages or disadvantages of doing it. I can tell you that, you know, staying alone forever and working on your projects without ever revealing them, without ever connecting with people. I remember at one point I was speaking to a school teacher who was doing a master's in education. I was doing at the time my PhD, and I always shared my texts with everybody to get advice. Sometimes, you know, they would find a few typos, repetitive words. Like one of the things I do is I repeat words and I don't see them anymore. And sometimes it's just like, have you thought of this? Or, you know, maybe add this, or did you, you know, sending me a reference. So to me, as soon as I have a draft, I like to share it. So I told her very nicely, you know, if you ever want to share your drafts, you know, I'm happy to read. And she said, oh, no, I can write.
Oh.
And the no, I can write was like almost like you wouldn't be able to help me with my French. And I was thinking, you're completely missing the ball on this. Like, first of all, yeah, I'm a French teacher, so I can correct your French, but I'm not saying you're not writing well. I'm saying that having another pair of eyes and putting your work out there in the open can be very beneficial, because you have another educator who's looking at your work. And maybe sometimes, you know, if I write something and somebody doesn't understand what I write, then you have to tell me what you're understanding from my write so that I can correct my pitch. Sometimes what comes out of my brain is not what you're expecting to read, but it's in this externalization of drafts, prototypes, ideas, projects, whatever else, and the conversation that happens around it that we can build excellence. So I think people need to start looking at this as the world doesn't work in isolation. And regardless of what you're going to get out there, you have to put yourself out there at one point. And the longer you wait, the more you feel you need to protect your CV or your project or your prototype or whatever else. And this ideology of protection will probably harm you in the long run more than help you. So that's basically on the note that I can end. I have another